Well, Reverend Tully, it's very nice to see you. I wasn't expecting
surprise
to see you tonight.
Came out of hiding.
So, as you probably know, somewhat by coincidence, some of the people who anchor the teaching here at the Zen Center are away. Jean Bush and Nanette Overly are at Tassajara teaching a workshop about teaching. They are teachers also. That's still going on, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And Kokyo, who is the head teacher here at Santa Cruz Zen Center, is at Green Gulch Farm for a few weeks, to be with his teacher, Tenshin Reb Anderson. And when he returns, he'll have new clothes, and he will be officially sort of sanctioned as a Dharma teacher, even though he already is that to us. But he'll have this kind of more official status in a couple of weeks. And those people, among others, including several here, are key to the kind of internal life of the Santa Cruz Zen Center, and Jean and Kokyo, and several people in this room, Kathy and Patrick in particular, are also sort of central to being the public face of the Santa Cruz Zen Center here in town and to a much wider Buddhist community. So we have this very kind of impressive, you know, kind of Dharma group of folks here. And actually, I would include everybody in the room who I know in that collection. So whether you like it or not, you know. Oh, I'm sorry. I forgot the president of the board and my co-ordinee. Trying to hide back in there in the corner, are you? Anyway, Beata is also very central to the life of Santa Cruz Zen Center, internally and externally. And one of the things that I noticed in getting ready for this talk, tonight I would like to talk about something we never really talk about publicly, which is the role of practice discussion and Dokusan in our practice lives. One of the things I did in preparation for this talk is I listened to many of the talks on our website. And I don't know if you've been on our website, but you can go there and you can download this stuff on your computer or iPod or MP3 player. And you can listen to these talks at your convenience. And it's a really interesting thing to do that. I don't know, probably others of you have done this much more than I have, but it's like you download it, you have it, you go, I want to deal with my karma, I'm going to listen to some Dharma. And you can garden, you can exercise, you can cook, you can kind of half watch TV, or you can just watch your screensaver, but you can do any number of things and listen to this. And Patrice knows this because I was listening to Kokyo today. I go, just a minute, I got to put Kokyo on pause. You can answer the phone and then come back to it. And it's a very different experience. It's portable Dharma, basically, Dharma to go. And I noticed when I began to listen to some of the talks that I began to kind of get selective about it. Like, oh, I want to hear about the Zui Mong Ki, or I want to hear about this. So, you know, even kind of the very selection of it is part of the experience of having the online Dharma Zen experience. And this may seem like I'm wandering a little bit, but actually I mentioned all of this because I wanted to say that the teaching of Dharma and the teachings, the teachers and the teaching, come in many different forms. And this aspect that I want to talk about is not a very kind of public form that we talk about very much together as a group. And I wanted to kind of share with you a little bit of my own experiences with this and my own aversions about it. And to maybe kind of get your ideas as well about how you think about this. You consider yourself a Zen student? You have a teacher? that you took precepts with or were ordained with, or maybe you study with someone else, or maybe you look to other practitioners for advice and kind of the one-on-one that comes with practice discussions in Dokusan. If you do have a teacher or have someone you consider a teacher to you, even if that person is not the person who ordained you or gave you the precepts, then what is the nature of your relationship to that person and how do you think about it? Because clearly that relationship is a little bit different than the one we hold together as Sangha members. And, you know, it's certainly easy for us to say, well, you find a teacher, you have a little, you know, connection synergy with them, you work with them, things go well, you become this or that, or you don't become this or that, and life unfolds. But it's actually, I think, much more complicated than that, as all intimate relationships are. So I wanted to first start by telling you a little story about what I did last weekend that kind of brought some of this into sharp relief for me. I didn't fully understand that I could come to talks at the Sesshin, so I went to San Jose and went to this thing called the Obon Festival. Has anybody ever been to a Obon Festival? This is like a nightmare from my childhood. Obon or Obonodori is the Japanese word for this kind of formal kind of Japanese dance, you know, that people do dressed in kimonos. And the Obon Festival is a Buddhist festival that's particularly associated with Jodo Shinshu or Shin Buddhism, which is really kind of the state-sanctioned Buddhism in Japan. And it's a dance festival that is meant to honor our ancestors, both Buddhas and familial ancestors. And one of the things about Shin Buddhism, which makes it very important in the Japanese American community, is that there's a lot of filial piety in it. So there's this kind of connection that is meaningful for Japanese first generation immigrants during the kind of turn of the century, and then the birth of the second generation in the 1920s and 1930s. And it's sort of passed down to the third generation, which is my generation, people that are boomers for the most part. Now, I say this is a nightmare for me because my mom used to dress my sister and I in little kimonos for Halloween with the obi and the fan and the little tabi. And, nightmare. If you're really like ultra femmy and you like to dress up, it's great, I suppose, but it just was not my thing. And I think I've destroyed all pictures as as evidence of this. And maybe once or twice when we were young, my family was not Buddhist, but we would go to a Buddhist temple. At that time, they were called Buddhist temple bazaars. And I went for the bento lunchbox. And I didn't really understand that the obon was part of a kind of Buddhist practice. So it turns out that this is, you know, there's a very lively obon thing that goes on in California and Hawaii and other states as well. And apparently the San Jose Buddhist Temple, which is, I think, on Jackson Street in downtown San Jose, has the largest Obon Festival in Northern California. And I just want to give you kind of a sense of the scale of this because it was really quite stunning. So I went on Saturday night, maybe around 6 o'clock. There were probably about 8,000 people there, kind of crammed into a maybe 4-square-block area. The main event of the night is the dance, of which there's like 12 dances. And there are about 1,000 dancers. So it's really this amazing sight to see the procession of dancers come down the street because they go for as far as the eye can see. And I'll say a little bit more about this in a minute. But this is an event that goes 2 days, so it's Saturday and Sunday. It's an all-day thing, but the dance happens like at 7 o'clock at night. And it's also a kind of street fair. So they have this food court that... We should go. We should do a field trip next year. They have this food court where you can buy teriyaki chicken, teriyaki beef, udon with, you know, fish cakes, strawberry shortcake, beer, other kinds of drinks. Yeah, no, beer. People are walking around with beer. Different kinds of Japanese sweets, like omochi, the kind of pounded sweet rice. What else? Oh, barbecued corn on the cob. Kind of the main staple of many street fairs. This is, I used to scream as a child for this. I want more corn on the cob! So there are probably like 1,000 people just in the food court, standing in line. And then there is a hall with maybe 100 tables, long tables, where people sit. People are eating out on the street. They're saying hello to their friends. It's this huge shindig. And there are temple tours. I spent a little time in the temple before the dances began. And then in addition to the food, the temple, there's bingo, which I actually remember as a Japanese-American. All the temple bazaars have bingo. So I didn't really get over to the bingo area because I was stuck kind of looking at the mochi, trying to figure out what... by choice, trying to figure out what to have. But I did notice it. And so as I said, this is a kind of Buddhism that's associated with you know, kind of Pure Land sect. So it's a kind of it's a part of the Mahayana stream of Buddhism. It coexisted with Zen in Japan, and it became really kind of the official state religion, as it were, of Japan during this period called the Tokugawa period, which is just right before the modern period. So it's not surprising then that this form of Buddhism is the most widely practiced Buddhism in Japan. And I would say that 9 times out of 10, if you meet a Japanese American who's a Buddhist, they go to one version or another of these temples. And as I say, my family was not religious in any way, but we went for the teriyaki chicken and the corn. I went for the chicken and the corn on the cob. So I spent a little bit of time in the temple, and it's set up like a church. There's a huge, enormous, beautiful altar. It's got a lot of gold, and it seems very kind of bright and shiny to someone like me. And they have these kind of, you know, on the back seat of the pew, the seat in front of you, there are these hymnals, or I guess I wouldn't exactly want to call them chant books, but they are basically kind of chant books. And the only one that I could recognize that is very similar to what we do is they do the refuges in Pali. And they have these kind of admonitions about the tones. And it made me interested in wanting to go hear a service sometime. And while I was sort of browsing the hymnals and kind of walking around looking at things in the temple, they have a bell like that one. And actually, they're bigger than us. They have two bells like that. And they do this thing where they actually let the congregation offer incense every time they have a service. So there's a big table kind of in front of the main altar, and there's two very large incensers, and then right next to the incensers there's donation bowls. So there's like this pot of money next to each incenser, and which, you know, is very, it's sort of jarring, actually, to a Zen practitioner, because we like to be especially modest and polite about the money issue, but boy, it's just right up front there. So... And it's not crude or anything like that. It appeared a little bit sort of askew to me. So those are some of the kind of differences I noticed. And there was a guy, all of the church senior people, the church historian, the temple historian was, they have these like matching purple polo shirts that say San Jose Buddhist temple. And he was giving a lecture on Mukherjee, who's, I guess, a contemporary he was one of several of the Buddha's main kind of arhats, and a contemporary of Shariputra, actually. So, and Mukherjee lectured, I guess, a bunch about, and with the Buddha, about filial piety. So the guy in the purple polo shirt is doing this lecture, and people are kind of walking in and out and up to the altar, and there are these, you know, little pamphlets that say, welcome to Jodo Shinshu, Pure Land Buddhism, and how you can participate. And meanwhile, you know, outside, there's like, on the porch of the temple, there's people talking on their cell phones, and, you know, there's a lot of noise, and people are sitting there with beer and cigarettes. It's quite a scene. So, like I said, the dance is the main event. And the only kind of very, I thought, potentially serious or kind of quiet and grave moment in this is the head priest of the temple leads the procession down Jackson Avenue with these 1,000 dancers in lined up 8 columns across the street. And I guess typically the priest, there are 3 big stages set up in the middle of the street. And the priest goes to one of the stages and makes a kind of invocation about honoring ancestors and honoring family members who have passed. And it was interesting, it was so noisy and so loud. And there was just so much, you know, like bustling around that this guy in black robes went up to the middle stage, and I can see him talking, but the mic wasn't really working and there was a lot of noise. So if he gave an invocation, none of us heard it. And then the dancing began, and there's a series of 12 dances, and the 1,000 dancers sort of circumambulate around the 3 stages. And that in itself was a very interesting phenomenon. I've always thought that when you do obon, it's mostly Japanese people who do this, or Japanese Americans. And this was the most kind of mixed, maybe 60% were Japanese American, maybe, including multiracial people. And then there were a lot of other people who were there. I don't know what their connection was to the church, but for example, I saw an African American family kind of lined up in kimonos, and I would see kind of, I mean, people who didn't look like they had, again, you know, this is sort of a perspective type thing, but I didn't see any sort of immediate connection that seemed like racially visible to the temple. And people were like whipping on kimonos and turning around the obis and kind of playing with the fans, and they had these little clacker things that go with obon dances. And, you know, clearly people take classes for a couple weeks before this event so that they know what the movements are and the steps. And there are professional dancers on the 3 main stages in the middle of the street. But all the, you know, kind of wannabes are, the 1,000 people are doing the circumambulation. I saw a guy actually doing the Macarena because he didn't really know what the steps were. And so, you know what the Macarena is? Someone will have to do the Macarena later for show. But it was really, you know, it was very funny, actually, and very amusing, and people are talking the whole time, and it's this very solemn, I thought, event. I mean, in compared with, for example, the Tsujiki ceremony that we did here during the Japanese Cultural Fair, it was very, I mean, I almost started to cry during that ceremony, because it was clear that a lot of people had come, and they were calling out the names of people in their families that were, or people that were close to them that had passed. And people offered incense, and then they left. And this had a really different atmosphere. So I'm sitting in the stand. There are these bleachers with my friends, a couple of whom were here at your and my ordination. And I'm thinking, okay, so this is Buddhism, and I'm not very familiar with it. Like, it doesn't feel familiar. And on the other hand, culturally, it feels very familiar to me, especially the barbecued corn on the cob. And so I'm thinking, these are my people, and this is my religious practice. I say my people a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but these are my people and this is my religious practice. And how come I feel weird? And so my discriminating mind has been abuzz over the last really week, 5 days since I was at this festival. Because, of course, I knew everyone else was, or many other people were sitting sesshin for 15 hours a day here. Completely kind of like the diametrically opposed opposite to hanging out with beer and bingo. So I'm sitting in the stands and the dances are going on. People are coming and going. They're kind of shouting to one another. They're taking pictures and people are leaving the dance line and saying hello to their friends in the stands and so on. And one of the things that I began to, I could tell you all the terrible places my discriminating mind went, but why contaminate you as well? I began to, I think, settle into this this set of questions about the relationships between the teachings, our teachers, and us. And as part of my discriminating mind, I thought, they don't really do Dharma the way we do. That was the first place my mind went. But I'm actually completely wrong about that, because they have classes, they do some meditation, they have services. In fact, they have this amazing thing called shindharmanet.com, in which you can take seminars, webinars, you can listen to lectures, you can learn about the forms. It's really like sort of a complete package type of thing. And and of course, you know, the sum of details of our everyday lives, that's a lot of what all Buddhist practice works with. And I felt that that clearly was in evidence because, for example, one of the people I was with, she says, oh yeah, I've been to this, they live in Alameda. So they had driven all the way to San Jose for this. There's, you know, virtually no parking. So you really, this is a lot of effort to go to this event. But her mother's younger sister had some family member who was associated with this Buddhist temple, and so all of their family funerals are held at this temple. So for the big serious events in life, the great matters, the temple is a very integrated part of their lives. So in spite of my efforts to be discriminating and as opposed to discerning and judgmental or critical and sort of kind of working with my own unease around the Obon Festival, I began to think about the way in which teachers are crucial for us here at Zen Center. In fact, our experience of Dharma is not complete without our teachers. And even the teachings that our teachers teach about are about teachers and students. You know, Dogen's Dharma Hall discourses, the koan practice. You remember last week, Kokyo was telling us one of I call them the 80% koans, where the teacher says something like, you know, what is the good of, what do all the eyes and hands of Avalokiteshvara, what do they do over the body? And the student has an answer and the teacher says, oh, not bad, but that's 80%. Well, there's a couple of koans like that. I love the 80% koans because the teacher always supplies the other 20%. And so even the teachings are about student-teacher interactions. And then, you know, sometimes we say the teachings are found in these activities that we do, like Zazen is my teacher, or your difficulties are your teacher. That's sort of not exactly the sense in which I'm thinking about teachers tonight. I'm thinking about the real embodied people who help us and in interaction with us, whether it be during Zazen or ceremonies or service or through Dokusan, they do this very important thing, which is they model for us how to live, which is a lot of what Buddhism is about. And it's an amazing gift to have that in our lives. Because as much as I feel, for example, that I try to find a good way to live, an appropriate way to live, I mess up. And so I hope nobody's watching too closely or thinking about me as a model. But I like to, you know, I like to have other people that I can depend on. And of course, you know that when this process that we do of picking a teacher is one that is based on very kind of normal, expected kinds of norms, like that we want our teacher to be compassionate, we want them to be knowledgeable, we want them to be not just having an intellectual knowledge of Dharma, but to have an embodied, experiential kind of knowledge. We want them to be courageous. We want them to be truthful and honest and yet kind, and all of these things. And so, and we often therefore pick a teacher that resonates with us or that we feel resonates with us. And how do we know if we resonate with someone? It's an interesting thing, right? You kind of get the warm fuzzy. Oh, they see me. I see them. I feel like I can learn a lot from them. And I'm struck by our work and efforts in picking a teacher, whether we talk to them on the phone or we see them face to face or we see them occasionally when they're passing through town, that this is a very important invitation for us to appear naked before them. I think that's some of the language that I've heard teachers use when they talk about a practice discussion or Dokusan. I think it's this very unique interaction that's different than the way we hang out on the porch or the way we say, well, I'm having a hard time. It's a place where the rubber meets the road, where the daily life meets practice, and we're getting help in both exposing ourselves and trusting, at least having some trust in the process that occurs in a Dokusan. People say it's a kind of intimate face-to-face meeting or interview. I think interview is not quite right as a word because we have all these ideas about what an interview is in terms of jobs or school. But I like to think of it as not a face-to-face, but a nose-to-nose or eyeball-to-eyeball meeting in which you're willing to bring your ghostly self, the one that doesn't exist but that nonetheless shadows you everywhere you go, and to bring it in. But as you know, when we have resonance with other people, it's a beautiful thing, and it's also that place where sometimes that resonance also contains the possibilities for dissonance or difficulties. And it's this interesting dynamic, I think, because, you know, when you have difficulty with a teacher, someone that you had a lot of faith or trust in, someone that you felt that you loved, someone that you felt that saw you or should see you or could see you if they really tried, these things bring us, you know, not just more opportunity to practice, but they carry with it some charge for us because of the ways in which we invest in our teachers. Some of us, for various reasons, we leave our teachers or we stop going. Or we become perhaps discouraged with practice. I don't think I know anyone who hasn't at some moment had some thought of one of these things. And I'm not actually suggesting that we should never leave our teachers or that we should always trust our teachers or that we should always love our teachers. I'm not suggesting that we ought not to have multiple teachers or that that's not a feasible model for us. It is kind of a buffet-style approach. But I do want to say just a little bit more about this, the intimacy of Dokusan and practice discussion. Because while a lot of this equation about Buddhist practice, the teachers, the teachings, and then our relationship to teachers and the teachings, while a lot of the weight of that relationship between us and our teachers that occurs, for example, say in the nose-to-nose meetings, about the things that are kind of normal, everyday things, whether they be death, illness, suffering, difficulties in relationships, difficulties at the Zendo, difficulties with our Sangha members, all of these things, this is the grist with which we practice. I wish we could say it was really just about world peace. Would it be that simple? It's not quite that straightforward. And I'm struck by, at least in my own experience, how, oh, by the way, you should know that I'm giving this talk in part because I have a terrible time with Dokusan. I am the most aversive person. Like, I feel almost like, unless I'm hanging off the cliff, I'm not going in. Because it's hard. It's hard. It's really, really hard. And it's not about liking the person. Although sometimes in my mind I might say, well, they would never understand this. It's too long to explain the whole thing. And so, you know, by the time I get done with it, it's like 3 hours or 3 days later. And so why would I put someone else through that? So I want to say this is a talk for myself, really, in a way. But this is the place where the opportunity to not turn away is deepest, I think. Because it's very easy for us, I think, and I myself have been in this practice of this habit of going in for Dokusan when I am most in need, when I'm desperate. And in a way, I think maybe that's not exactly the right moment to go for Dokusan. I mean, of course, that's when we go. That's the reality of daily life as a Buddhist practitioner. It's like, I'm too busy right now, but hey, when everything hits the fan, I'm in there. I'm signing up, and I'm like, why aren't they calling me? Don't they know I need to see them? Dokusan is not like, I don't think it's like confession, although I've never been to confession. I don't think it's like therapy. I have been to therapy, but I don't think of it like therapy. Here's why I think it's not like either of those two things. I think we bear a tremendous... an important part of responsibility as our practice to go back again, to return again. That is, to not turn away. So, for example, I used to think that I was just taking up a teacher's time if I asked for regular Dokusan. There have been times when I've been desperately, regularly in need, but again, as I said, as I think back on this, in a way, the work that we do, we sit zazen, we listen to lectures, we do our MP3 players online. Both Shoho and Kathy and Kokyo all sound great online. But it's not the same as when you're doing this kind of reflexive, integrative work with practice in your own life. And one of the things that I have defaulted to is that when I don't feel like I get the right response or the proper amount of empathy or the right fixes or the things that would make me feel better, then I have a tendency to be much more aversive to Dokusan or to practice discussion. And I've recently... I suppose maybe this is just a little piece of practice. I wanted to ask you how you think about this, because part of the way I have been thinking about it is now I feel like if I really want to practice and be reflexive, that is self-reflexive about my own practice, then I need to show up for this thing that I don't really have this immediate instinct about going to. Because I think this is one of the things that in my mind that you can't get from shindharmanet.com or even from listening to us on MP3, in MP3 files online at the Santa Cruz Zen Center. Even our Wednesday night lectures, you know, it's a different thing, of course, for us to sit together and speak Dharma. And it's certainly a fair distance from doing the dishes and listening to Robert Thurman or, you know, whatever one does when we're listening to MP3 files. But there's a way in which the self-reflexive part, the part where we're working at it and thinking about it, needs to have some voice and have some expression. You know, one of the things that I did before Kokyo left is I had a practice discussion with him, and I'd asked him if I could have somewhat regular practice discussions with him, even though I don't feel like I know him very well, and it's a little bit odd because, or I don't know if it's odd, but in my mind it was a little bit odd since I was ordained by Catherine, and so on. I could go on about this, but it's, you know, it's, I don't know that that's as important as I wanted to say that in order for us to step forward and to kind of work in our own practice realms, that place, that nose-to-nose, eyeball-to-eyeball place, I think is a very significant one. And it lays the groundwork for when all the stuff does hit the fan, which eventually, at some point, it does. Because people get sick that we love. We have relationship difficulties. We have work difficulties. The list of difficulties is so inexhaustible, I don't even want to quite go there. But I'll just tell you one of in the last discussion with Kokyo, I think he said something like, well, so what are you doing? And, you know, all the chattiness and kind of, I want to say, light conversation that we would have normally on the deck of the Zendo or out on the patio, it's different in Dokusan because it really is this invitation to step forward. And so I told him about a situation that I'd been having some difficulty with, a kind of, you know, envy, anger type situation. And I also apologized to him for something that was kind of small, but that was really important to me, that occurred at a weekend sit that we did at Tassajara. And I'll just tell it to you really quickly. Because although it felt really small and I wasn't really sure it was worth taking the time to say something about to him, it was significant enough that I felt like it telescoped something about my own practice and the areas of difficulty that I have. And that was, somehow I ended up in the dawn seat for a noon service at Tassajara. And, you know, at Tassajara, the dawns are trained ad nauseum, and for services and for the echoes. And so I'm sitting there with all these bells, and, you know, if you've been to Tassajara, you know the big bell is enormous and I can't see over it. So I'm thinking, how am I going to see over this? And kind of go like this, you know. And I got the big striker out, and Kokyo's at the top of the buying mat, and he comes over to me and he says, do you want the echo? And the assembly's waiting. And I said, no, I got it. And because I just assumed it was, you know, may our intention equally extend. And so it turns out that wasn't the echo. But in that moment where he was offering me the chant book or the echo book, I said no, because I'm focused on the big bell and how I'm going to ring it, and am I going to actually see it, and will I be able to see him? And I didn't really realize until the next day that the echo is completely different. That there is really, you know, the regimen or the kind of routine at summer in Tassajara has a quite different echo. And so what I said to him was, you know, that was really, I mean, I could tell you that's my insecurity, which of course that played a part in it, but it was also my arrogance that I can do this. I'm hoping it'll kick in, that I'll remember it goes, you know, may our intention. And now as I think about it, and as I'm telling you, I'm thinking, yeah, it's a pretty tiny thing, you know. It's not that big a deal. But it is, actually, because, or at least to me, it seems like a big deal. Because I think it's a little piece of something that is cultivated in myself that is likely to show up in some other place at another time. And of course, we can't ward against all of the ways that our habits and delusions are going to show up at any given time. But I think for us, because we are abundant with Dharma teachers here, Catherine, Kokyo, we have a couple Dharma teachers in waiting, Jean and Patrick, and there's a lot of senior students here who would be more than terrific at doing practice discussions with us, that in a way we can do that with ourselves, which would enhance our own practice in both kind of giving and receiving. And that kind of commitment to Dharma is the place where, at least in my mind, I get to step forward as opposed to be a passive recipient. And I don't know if this is an appropriate way or even an interesting way to think about it, but there was something about the Obon Festival that made me think about kind of passively taking in Dharma versus actively enacting and kind of working at it in a very consistent way. And this is not to say that Shin Buddhists don't do that, but it's just to say that in our tradition, this is the first way in which I can think of that we get to actively seek it out and enact it. And so we, in effect, we commit to the process of self-reflection and self-reflexiveness with the help of our senior students and our teachers. And so for the years that I've sat in, I didn't like the way that ended up, or I don't like the way that got said, that in a way is, you know, my own excuse for not stepping forward more. And it sounds painful, doesn't it? I mean, it can be very painful to step forward, because that when you step forward and you're naked, then it's the potential for getting hurt or having something hurtful said to you that you then take and say, wow, that's hurtful. Ouch, I'm not going back there again, is very high. And yet, you know, that also is part of the deepening of practice, to see where the self gets hurt and where we can work with that rather than withdraw. And because I think I can pretty safely say I tend to go to the aversive side, this is where I am trying to work myself. So why don't I imagine someone might ask, like, what's the difference between practice, discussion, and Dokusan? I thought I would let someone else answer that. Would you like to?
Are you asking us that question? Would you like someone to ask it of you?
I'm not sure. I have an answer, but I don't know if I know the answer. I'm not even sure.
Is that all right?
Sure.
So as you talked about the Obon Festival, I was thinking, wow, I wonder what people who come here to the Japanese cultural fair think of the Sajiki ceremony. They're going, wow, those Zennies, man, they use symbols, and they chant really long chants, and we all got to offer incense. And then they come to Sajiki and go, ho, wait a minute. I don't know. So we don't always get the whole impression, like you said, but... But my question to you is, you know, you talked throughout your talk about the role of the student, you know, to show up, to be naked, to, you know, to be wholehearted, you know, but what do you think is the role of the teacher in practice discussion, or dose?
Well, I like my teachers to, you know, to always come back at me with compassion and a fairly neutral place. For me, the most helpful Dokusans has been where someone has a pretty quick turning statement that just cuts right through to the matter. And And it's not a judgmental kind of comment. It's just the truth as they see it. Not very many teachers have done that with me. So that's, you know, that's kind of how I like it. But I don't know that my desires around this are appropriate exactly, because I also think that our relationship with teachers, like our relationships with our family and our friends and our pets and our children, it's not always warm fuzzy. And so it's how you process through those difficulties that we get heard. So if I feel like I get heard, I think that is the most important thing to me. What about for you?
Well, I mean, I think it's a huge question, and I think that ultimately for me, the difference between Zen and other forms of practice is that intimacy, just one-to-one intimacy. And I do think that calls for something different from both people. It's co-created, and it's transparently co-created between the two people. So it's not just an opportunity to have the interaction, but also to see the interaction, to see what's co-created there with open eyes, both parties, regardless of whether it's pretty or not, or whether it feels good or not to either party, actually. but for me, it should encourage practice. And that doesn't always feel good either.
Right.
Encouraging practice is sometimes bumping me up against something I don't want to look at.
Right.
But it's also holding me in that spot. And so for me, it's really about the intimacy. And I'm in the process of a situation with my teacher right now where, you know, sometimes, I mean, my teacher really shows up and meets me. And sometimes I'm like, wow, what just happened? and both of those can be fruitful.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think the underpinning of all of that is we have to show up. You're right. I mean, I go right there. We both have to agree to come back here, no matter what happens, by the end, for either party.
Right.
And I think that's a hugely brave act.
It's very scary.
Yeah. Rare on both sides.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I guess I'll ask the question about the difference between practice discussion and Dokusan.
Mm. I don't know, but I'll tell you my operative understanding of it. I have two operative understandings of it. One is that Dokusan is something, is a, the interview or the meeting with a Dharma teacher. Often your teacher, but not necessarily your teacher. And practice discussions, on the other hand, are discussions that you have with other Dharma leaders, for example, head students or priests, maybe? Or, no, head students, I guess, would be a Tassajara, the line, right? I know some people, and this would go into the second operative definition. Some people would say, I think, that any discussion that you have with someone who's not your teacher, your root teacher, is a practice discussion. Have you heard that? No?
I've heard more of the first one you described.
So I've used both kind of in some ways interchangeably here because I'm not so sure exactly that the to me, what's unique about our practice is the commitment to have that discussion, which is, I think, more important than whether you're having it with the person who's got a brown robe or who's a shuso or something like that, to have that discussion. I'm wondering, others of you that go in for Dokusan and have practice discussions, do you go in willingly? Or do you go in willingly? I mean, are you excited about going in, or do you feel... I mean, I used to be excited about it, and for some reason it's changed.
Yeah. I've gone willingly 3 times. And I think, just to put it out there, I think every single time I felt like, what if I'm empty? What if I go in there and I have nothing to say? Because I never go for something specific. I just go and see what happens, and I'm always pleasantly surprised. Mm-hmm.
So you go even though you don't have something specific. You go kind of as a, like a...
Yeah, I think I have the, I've always had this need to have somebody that's being aware of my practice mm-hmm. a little bit more than mm-hmm. my own awareness.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But, you know, to answer, for me to answer the question between, you know, a discussion, a practice discussion with someone like during our teas
mm-hmm.
and Dokusan, for me there's no difference.
Mm. I was going to do a shameless plug, which I guess I'll do now since Sally just brought it up, but Kathy Toldy and I and Sally and Rob anchor a Sunday night discussion group that occurs an hour before class during the Zazen period on Sunday nights. And it's modeled after a discussion, the group discussion that occurs during practice period, when the students in the practice period get together. And I think we're still kind of working with, you know, kind of the form and all of that, but we've done it for what, a month or so?
Yeah, a couple months.
And, I wept through the first two meetings, so it's not like people could go, well, let's chat. But, you know, obviously what we bring to it, it matters a huge deal. And I think our experience shows that we can do this and hold the space and have it be, you know, kind of in the genre a practice discussion. Sure.
I confess that part of the talk I was trying to get the corn and the cob together with the Dokusan.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of couldn't connect the two. Yeah. And then over time where I am right now, I'm just really baffled about the honesty and revelation you're bringing forward and kind of like the two Buddhists in you know, the one you grew up with and the one that you're practicing right now, and you're underlining the part of you that you are treasuring right now of this kind of form of intimacy, and you're totally doing it at the same time. Like, you're sitting there and you're totally revealing yourself, you're stepping forward so intimately towards us, so you're not only talking about practice discussion, you're showing us you're stepping forward consciously. It touches me very much, and I really appreciate that. And yet I wonder if, like, you know, because I kind of don't want to let those people disappear over the hill, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I want to love them too.
Mm-hmm.
And those people dancing and, you know, in kimonos.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wonder actually if, like, over time, this revelation that, like, gets nurtured in practice discussion and Dokusan happens in our community, like right now, and then can carry it forward towards things that look really strange. And it's hard, like you said, there's like so much discrimination bumping against, our minds bumping against.
Yeah.
And yet, that's where our work is. It's very choosy, you know, to go into situations that seem so odd and so unease.
Yeah.
Unease places, and like being able to bring intimate connection even to that. So thank you for painting this whole picture. Appreciate it.
Thank you. I'm also, I hope you can tell, I'm clamoring for a field trip next July. So that you can, Piotr wants
to
go?
Will you wear a kimono? And also, I just want to mention, the pictures, but you just recorded in perpetuity online in a Dharma talk. You wore kimonos.
Thank you.
So my mom used to like put the like white paint on us, on our faces, and the big red lips, and hey there. I did have hair back then, and I think, you know how they have those little hair pins with little dingly bob things that hang off of it? There were those, and I had a fan, and the kimono, and Patrice.
You know, I have
to get that image out of my head. Pretty shocking.
So, a little while ago you were talking about all the different forms of, some different forms of these ceremonies that are sort of Dokusan-like, like, you know, psychotherapy, the Catholic sacrament of reconciliation, practice discussion, Dokusan, and another one which I experienced last week, which I didn't expect to be in that same genre, but it was at a writing workshop. It was at Bookshop Santa Cruz, where we were given some prompts and had to like write for 5 minutes without stopping. And then after that, it was like time to read your writing out loud to the stranger sitting next to you, to which I said, I'm so out of here before that happened. And because we had the option to do it or not do it. But interest of, you know, you said, not turning away is a part of practice discussion. I think it's a part of every ceremony that has some sort of authentic encounter. And it can be in any one of these meetings, including, like, it was really amazing how it manifested in that writing workshop with a total stranger, somebody I'd never even met before. So one thing that I've been pondering as I'm listening to your talk is what makes these, having engaged in all these kind of meetings, every single one of those forms, including both sides of the psychotherapy equation and confession, reconciliation, you know, everything else, is what supports that ability what supports the not turning away, and what enables it to be something where you can come back again and again. And so to me, I always automatically, because it's such a big issue for me in my life, go to trust. And so I can think of many times when in all those scenarios I've had interactions that didn't feel good, but yet because of some trust I would come back. And other times they didn't feel good, but their trust wasn't there, so I didn't go back. Or sometimes it really did feel good, and in a way that I felt was based on trust, or sometimes it really did feel good, but I didn't feel like I was able to show up that meaningfully. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So I just was wondering about your thoughts about what trust is and what it is in this type of a ceremony.
Yeah. That's a good question, because there is a huge gray area between the opportunity for intimacy in practice discussion or Dokusan, and the occasion of some kind of inequity or kind of misalignment that actually is painful to the extent that we feel that we're not able to recover from it, or we can't process it in a way. So I think it's very individual. As Beata says, you know, we co-create this with the person sitting across from us. I know that when I'm able to go back again, it's because, for me, I'm clear about my own boundaries, which happens about once every 50 years for me. It means that I could actually go speak with someone, and I'm now thinking about people at the university as well as Zen teachers and family members, in which I know that that person comes with a partisan view, and I object to it at some level, or I don't understand it, so I can't take it in and enact it. And is that trust? Yeah, it is partly trust, but it's also when I feel secure enough that I can go back regardless of that. It's almost like, oh, it's not personal. They just think that, you know, I should do this and this and this, or this is the way the world should look. Now, I want to say that's a very frail relationship that we have with people in positions of some, not exactly authority, but maybe moral, spiritual authority with respect to us. And, you know, it has to, I think, be gauged very individually. Because if you're hurt in a way in which you feel like, you know, you crawl back like this, then unless you feel like there's some good in crawling back like that, I don't know that that's a good thing to do. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, it does. I think it's very complicated, like you say, and because people can be harmed.
Yes.
You know, you can be harmed by, you know, letting down your boundaries in your garden, showing up naked, and that can be depending on, I mean, not just in, if it's public practice discussion, but it's also possible in all these other relationships as well, you know. And so then it's kind of that sorting out process is maybe where the encounter or where the practice happens then.
Right.
I think within oneself it's like, oh, okay, what happened? And I know for me it can take a long time to settle, I don't even want to say an understanding, but to settle on some sort of a peacefulness with what happened and what the next step is.
Mm-hmm.
Not even maybe what the whole relationship is going to be or that whole path or that whole ceremony, but just what that next step is. And I think it can happen with, you know what, I've been practicing the last 2 weeks with car dealers. It can happen with anyone. And you encounter that comes at you strongly and you're vulnerable for some reason, and then you have to, all this stuff happens and you have to figure out, like, okay, what's happening here? You know, I mean, that, you know, there's a practice anywhere, I think.
Yeah. I hesitate to say anything, you know, universal or kind of that's true for everyone, because I think, you know, it's well documented that there's a lot of abuse and kind of mishandling of subordinate-superordinate relationships, both in religious communities and lots of other places as well. So I think the potential for damage is great. So I completely agree. So I'll just say, assuming, for example, just with me and some of the practice leaders around here, I feel like, for me, the practice is to go back again. I feel, in a way, sturdy enough that I could go back again. And that would be just this week. But, you know, next week might be completely different. But that is the, you know, when we say not turning away, it's really when you go in for practice in Dokusan, it's about, I mean, you're bringing yourself. You're not just prostrating yourself and saying, okay, here I am, what are you going to do? Can you fix this? You're saying, help me with this. And then you can walk out of there and say, that was really not, that didn't feel very helpful.
Which doesn't necessarily mean that it wasn't.
Right. That's right. That's right. It may take a long time of simmering and settling and more experiences, life experiences, for us to sort it through. Which is a nice radical way of saying, I don't know. Thank you. Hannah.
I think for those in the room who perhaps haven't had a lot of practice discussion at Dokusan, I would like to say that the difficult or painful or hurtful experiences are extremely rare in my experience in the whole great numbers of them. They happen, but they're extremely rare. And perhaps one of the most hurtful ones that ever happened to me took me 10 years to figure out the absolute truth of the thing that was said. Like, I finally, oh yeah, okay, I get it now. You know, it just felt like an attack, but actually, it was stunning truth. So there's that. I just wanted to say that. The other thing is that in Chicago on Sunday mornings, I used to go to the Jodo Shin Temple.
That's a big one there, I understand.
And the priest, who I heard was, and perhaps still is now, the spiritual head of the Buddhist Churches of America, was actually a student of Suzuki Roshi's and practiced. And so he has an approach which is Shin Zen. Mm-hmm. And he led us in meditation early on Sunday mornings before everybody got there and filled up the pews and opened the hymn books. And he gave a little, and we offered incense, and then he gave a little Dharma talk. And those Dharma talks were stunning. I mean, they were short and just opened you like nothing I've experienced from anyone ever since. Every time he spoke, he would just break open reality and I would be in tears. That was quite amazing. So if Reverend Koshin Ogui is somewhere in San Francisco, I highly recommend that. Or he visits occasionally, I think, Watsonville, etc. It would be really good to go here. So that's very sure.
Thank you for both comments. Rich.
Thank you for this topic this evening. I've had some practice discussions with Kokyo, and I wanted to ask someone what they're supposed to be about, but I didn't want to ask Kokyo. But I kind of did. I always had something nagging me that I wanted to talk about. Of course, the first one was just me talking about myself, thinking that it was important that he knew what weird ideas I had about Buddhism. But I actually did ask, I think, at one, what do? He said you can talk about anything you want. So I went, oh, okay. But I wondered, and from the discussion now I can see that it's an open book. It's anything that might be relevant to start a practice discussion for Dokusan. It was the beginning of the winter practice period when I joined the Sangha. So it was recommended to have a practice discussion. This is perfect. I got the impression that maybe it was only during practice periods that one did this, but I wasn't sure. And I really liked the idea of a regular ongoing set of discussions. But I, when you said something that reminded me of a feeling that I've had, it's like, I don't want to be a pest. I mean, you didn't say that, but I felt like, how often can I do this? And so that's my question, I guess. How is once a month nice and regular and not too often? Or
well, other people should say what they think. For me, I was thinking every other week, every 3 weeks. I'm sure if any of the people that you have discussion with, including Kokyo, can't accommodate that, they'll just say, we can't do that. Rather than, no, you don't deserve that. Or whatever, you know, we're most afraid of when it comes to asking for discussions. It's a very humbling thing, I think, to even ask, actually, to say, please, may I have a practice discussion with you? But that's something that you could hatch out with Kokyo. Kathy?
But I think you can also have a practice discussion or Dokusan every day, every week. I mean, I think that it's the teacher or the senior student who is being requested would be the one to set the boundary and say, hey, it's getting to be a little much. But I've had periods in my own practice when seeing a teacher every day was incredibly helpful. because you just picked up where you left off and you just kept going and you kept going and you kept going. And I think that I don't think that it's considered being a pest at all. I think it's kind of opposite, that I think Dharma teachers, for the most part, love when there's requests. And again, if it was too much, that you can trust that the person would put that boundary in. But I would encourage you or anybody who is curious or who wants to have that kind of relationship. I think it's one of the hidden treasures of Zen. You know, we don't so much put that on the website.
Yeah.
But really, the opportunity to have deep, ongoing, regular Dharma conversations, you know, be it with one person or with a variety of people, is one of the treasures of our tradition.
Thank you.
So, thank you. See you in practice discussion. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them.
Oh.